in fact, quite more optimistic. The history has shown that immigrants and refugees will again be toyed with. They will be used as political fodder. They will be we become the threat of this country, and many of us are just tired of it, which is why we want to change the narrative entirely. But definitely, after all of that, be sure you go and listen to USA versus Garcia Luna, because it is mind-blowing. As we say, it's true crime meets telenovela. It's so crazy we had to bring out a bottle of tequila, because there was just no way to understand this story unless we were able to have a little tequila along with it.
Well, Maria Hinojosa, we want to thank you for being with us, as well as Penile Ramirez. Your series are amazing. We will link to the new investigative podcast, Death by Policy in USA versus Garcia Luna. And congratulations on your memoir for young people, Once I Was You, Maria. That does it for our show. Juan, I can't wait for Friday. Juan Gonzalez is speaking at CUNY, City University of New York School of Labor and Urban Studies, at 3 p.m. You can check our website for the address. And also on Monday at 6
p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland.
And good morning, everybody. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you so much for tuning in. I know we've been having some technical difficulties. And the Monday and Tuesday talk shows weren't able to go on. You know, we really depend upon the listeners' call-ins. These are, you know, call-in talk shows. So, but, you know, I thought it was important to carry it on the best we can. And also, I wanted to have my old co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, back on the air. She is arriving momentarily. And so, yeah, we're going to be back live, the two of us, after she stopped doing her show, her co-hosting, and took up her own show, which she had told me was intended to be for about 6 months. I think she went for a little longer than that. She wanted to tie in her indigenous perspective on U.S. history and to the rise in Trumpism and the January 6th insurrection and many other things. Hope you got to tune into some of that. So that was just John Trudell. Jackie's just walking in the door, getting settled. He actually passed away 7 years ago tomorrow, I believe. December 8th, 2015. He was a Native American author, poet, actor, musician, and political activist. He was a spokesperson for the Indians of All Tribes Take Over Alcatraz beginning in 1969, broadcasting as Radio Free Alcatraz. During most of the 1970s, he served as the chairman of the American Indian Movement. And I could tell you more, but I did just get a message from his longtime singer, Quiltman, from Warm Springs, saying that they're putting together a small festival tour in Portland, Nisqually, and Puyallup in February. And we'll be bringing that to you here on KBOO. He's got Gary Farmer, Keith Sokola. I played some Keith Sokola on my Monday folk show a couple weeks ago. Casper from Hopi Land, a native reggae artist. David Huckfelt and the Bad Dog Band, which was, you just heard there, Trudell's old band. So that should be exciting. Looking forward to that. That's just a heads up on that. And looks like Jackie's ready. Good morning, Jackie.
Hi, Paul.
Here we are again.
Yeah, totally.
So welcome back.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. I see you over there now.
Yeah, we're in different rooms. I'm kind of set up to, I got a bunch of stuff to talk about with the membership drive and various other things, articles. Before we do get started, I just want to hear, so people know, we've had these air room issues. There was a power outage a week ago. That was when I was supposed to be on live last Wednesday, which caused great consternation for me and others, and caused us to go off the air for many, many hours until about about nine or so. The outage fried our UPS, whatever that is, and one of our network switches, which is causing all kinds of unusual equipment failures in the station. And it's a bad time because we are in our membership drive. So, you know, we want to put our best foot forward here, and we're doing our very best to do it. And of course, that does go to showing how much we do need your support during this time of our membership drive, which is our end of the year drive from November 29th to December 31st. And just a reminder before we get into the show here that as I said, we are a listener-sponsored station. We totally depend. 80% of our funding comes from your support as listeners. So you can go to text KBOO to 44321. You can go to KBOO.fm and click on donate. Or you can send a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And we'll be talking about that as we go along. But first, I'm trying to find... Well, we're going to be talking about your research into the Pretendian issue, which you've been doing for, gosh, you said going on 7 years now when you first started out. And, of course, you came to national prominence. Not that you didn't have national prominence before, but your article for the, your op-ed for the San Francisco Chronicle made something of a splash about Sachin Littlefeather. So before we kind of go into the, you know, sort of the background, the deeper background, and, you know, how the Pretendian issue has sort of developed over the years, just maybe go into that. What was that all about?
Yeah, I'd say that, you know, growing up as a kid, my parents, you know, when both of my parents are American Indian, my father's a Yankton Sioux tribal member, and my mother's Navajo. I'm enrolled in the Navajo Nation. And I remember hearing as a kid my parents complaining about, you know, what they called wannabes at the time, you know, people who were falsely claiming to be American Indian. There was particularly authors, like my parents would go to parties and like white couples would show them these books they were reading, and they were invariably written by fakes, right? And my parents would come home talking afterwards like, oh, it was so irritating and stuff like that. And I remember there's just a number of ones that came out. I can't remember all their names. We have one to be Jaime Estes Storm, who wrote Seven Arrows. The Cheyenne Nation actually took the publisher to court in the early 70s and won and got a settlement out of that. It's still being published and sold. And even though it's, you know, it's clearly fiction and the author is not Native, you can read Amazon reviews and people still think that person is Indian, even though they lost in court in like 1971, right? And so I just grew up hearing about this stuff, but I thought it was quite rare, you know. But then once I became, you know, started interviewing a lot of Native people for articles and journalism on other topics, I began to hear, you know, people telling me, oh, you know, this person's fake, this person was outed this time. And I began to realize that there wasn't some sort of memory of it. We're not like, we just don't remember that this has happened. And so a lot of effort went into outing a fraud, and yet the fraud persists, right? And, you know, several decades later. My own college, Dartmouth College, hired a Pretendian over other qualified Native people, even Dartmouth alums who were Native. It was to run the Native American program. And the Native American program at Dartmouth is not an academic program. It's a counseling position to retain Native students. And Dartmouth has a very high graduation rate of Native students, I think around 90%, maybe a little bit more than that. Which is quite high for Native college students. And one of the ways they do this is they have, you know, the support system built in. And I was appalled that they had hired a Pretendian, because, I mean, can you imagine being a Navajo kid from the res back east in New Hampshire, you know, with all these white fraternity brothers and the Dartmouth Review, a really conservative paper, you know, just sort of, it's a publication that has ties to the National Review. And you know, being stuck out there in the woods with all these white fraternity bros, and turning to a Pretendian for support, it's just such a weird kind of almost a form of abuse, you know, and it's having someone mimic your experience back at you and be paid for it, you know. I did a piece in 2017. First in Indian Country Today, and then I published another piece in the Daily Beast. Her name was Susan Taff-Reed. She still is employed there. They took her out of the Native American program position, Dartmouth did, and then hid her away on campus until the media storm blew over. And then they made her dean of freshmen. Yeah. You know, the Native American alumni of Dartmouth have been trying to make that program director position a deanship, but have not been able to. We were working on that for 20 years before she was hired, and of course she was promoted upwards, you know, failing upwards, so she's still there, so that was my first article. And then I continued to write articles as the topic came up. You know, I did a piece for on frauds in the art world, focusing particularly on Jimmy Durham, the fake Cherokee artist, in El Palacio magazine. And then I did another piece for NBC News about Elizabeth Warren, her claims to DNA claims and stuff, and why DNA is not used in determining tribal citizenship. You can't figure out your tribe using DNA, and so unless you're actually using it for paternity testing, right? And then of course I got into covering the Sashine Littlefeather thing. It's been coming quite a while with a lot of different articles I've written over the years.
So it is something that has been paid attention to in among Native Americans, but not, as you say, it never really coalesced as a thing. It seems like the Sachin Littlefeather, which we'll get into the nuts and bolts of that issue soon, but that really kind of galvanized things to some extent. But it's been a long time developing. Anyway, so Sachin Littlefeather was, well, you just tell the story of what was her actual birth name?
Yeah, so her birth name was Maria Cruz. And you know, American Indian people do have Spanish surnames, and that's not unusual. There are Indian families with the surname Cruz. But the question is this particular family related to the tribes that she was claiming? And that's the question I really looked at in the U.S. side, because she was claiming to be an American Indian, which I did a piece, my last piece in the Chronicle gave a definition, and it was a definition. Sometimes it feels like the reporting on this issue has been really bad, because first of all, there's no fact checking, right? And then secondly, the definitions used by most journalists they don't know what an Indian is. Literally, it's just self-identification. Whoever claims it is it. But Native people in this country are citizens of tribes, which are Native nations that have persisted despite colonization and occupation of their homelands by the most powerful government in the world. We have serious issues that we need to address with that government that is occupying our homelands, sometimes in obviously military ways, as we saw at Standing Rock. And we are the only ones who have standing to address these issues, because our families were subject to the policies of the U.S. government that were directed at American Indian communities and tribes. And the reason they were directed at us, whether it's boarding schools, what have you, is because we have a claim to the land the U.S. claims as its mainland, its lower 48 states. So, people who are trying to insert themselves into this conversation by claiming to be us and speak for us, trying to paint a history of being subject to Indian federal law and policy by the U.S. government and by the states, is basically co-opting and acting in ways that are incredibly predatory towards our trauma that is derived from those experiences. If your family has been identifying as white legally in this country for, in Sachin's family's case, 100 years, 120 years at least, 140 years, there's just no way that they have been subject to Indian federal law policy. Sachin Littlefeather gave interviews in articles about Indian foster care issues, which is a real issue, but it was only applied to Indian children who were identified as Indian and living in federal, in American Indian communities, not people who identified as white.
So for people who actually still don't know who she is, which is hard to believe, because she actually, she died in October. The timing was very strange and interesting, but she died just after the in 1973 she at Marlon Brando's behest didn't accept, went in his place to the Academy Awards, which he had won an Academy Award for The Godfather, and gave a short speech, not the longer speech that he had written on his behalf, refusing the award on the grounds of the mistreatment of Native Americans largely, and which was a very excellent gesture on his behalf, and he was a strong supporter of Native rights, etc. But she became a very a national figure at that time, and then she kind of leveraged that And also, you know, she'd been involved in stuff and had taken on that identity already, which is why she got that into that situation. Anyway, and then the Academy of Motion Picture just apologized just shortly before her death, and then for her treatment, because, well, you can go into all that and more if you want, and then we'll get into other issues.
Yeah, so I, you know, growing up, going to powwows and stuff as a kid, you know, I don't recall anybody believing she was American Indian. And
oh, really?
No, I don't recall that. Not amongst Indian people, do I mean? And then when I worked, when I was just out of college, I worked in Oakland, California, for the American Indian Child Resource Center. I ran their teenage pregnancy prevention program, and for Native youth in Alameda County. And I met lots of old timers who had been in Alcatraz, and none of them really knew who she was, and they didn't. You know, a lot of people were quite skeptical of her claims. I mean, the most common refrain I heard was that people thought she was Filipina. Right. And so it was really a shock to me to find out that people actually believed it, because I never heard that growing up. And, you know, my mom had run, my parents had been quite active in the American community. And actually, my dad even helped Russell Mead start the AIM office in Cleveland. And nobody seemed that familiar with her. Most people seemed really skeptical. So when we began, I started investigating a list of about 200 suspected frauds. You're trying to verify their stated claims to identity, you know, and we did look at hers, and we found that she was not Filipina, but she was actually, her mother was, white, Dutch and mostly Dutch and German descent. Her oldest ancestors here on this continent, in the United States, were Dutch colonists in Manhattan and Brooklyn. Her family were of Dutch nobility, and they were one of the first. They owned Brooklyn. They were the first owners of Brooklyn. They'd taken the land from the tribes and stuff. So she's a direct descendant of colonists, and more recent Dutch and immigrant. Both her grandmother, her great grandmother, are both from Dutch. Recent immigrants as well from those same countries, And then her father's family were, Mexican American, from Sonora, and identified as white in this country from when they first arrived in the 1870s to be working in a copper mine in southern Arizona. There's a lot of mining in Sonora, so there was a lot of skilled miners there, and so when they began opening mines in southern Arizona, Sonoran miners came across to work. And they were quite good workers and very skilled. And they had come to Sonora before that from all over Mexico. So they weren't necessarily from Sonora itself. They came from all over because it was kind of a mining boom in Sonora that preceded the one in Arizona. And so the Cruz family line goes straight back to Mexico City, the paternal line and stuff. So not anywhere from tribes there locally. And one of the things I should note is that in Sonora, there was a genocide committed by mestizo Mexicans against the Yaqui, and it was quite horrific. I mean, you can see the lynching photos online. You can Google that. And then also they had bounties for body parts of Yaqui people, which is quite horrific. I'm getting ready to publish a Substack right now on my Substack about I'm working with a Yaqui historian and you know this history, because I was really shocked. I hadn't realized the level what had happened there. And under Porfirio Diaz, the dictator, who himself was mestizo, he actually de facto enslaved several thousand Yaqui people and deported them to the Yucatan and worked them to death, making baling twine for hay. Yeah, and so. I can't say that ever happened to either of my tribes. You know, they were not worked to death in slavery, several thousand of them. It's quite shocking how the Yaqui were treated. And so when you talk about determining whether a family from Sonora, a mestizo family, is Yaqui or not, you really need to have definitive confirmation, because they could have been the people lynching or collecting bounties. on Yaqui body parts. And you don't want to uplift a family that was engaged in that as Indian. So,
of course, we don't know that either.
But my task was determined, was she, her main claim was White Mountain Apache, which she began claiming. I did a, on my Substack, I have a 44-page.
And Yaqui, that's why you're
She didn't start claiming Yaqui till the late 80s, around 1990. That's the earliest. She was claiming a federally recognized tribe in the United States starting in 1971. We could find in print the claims. She was claiming White Mountain Apache. And, so my task was determined if she had no relations to that tribe whatsoever. Her family had never had any contact with them. They also, once they entered the United States, had never had any contact with the Yaqui community in Arizona. They didn't marry them. They never married anyone who claimed to be Indian. We looked at all of her cousins, her great aunts and uncles. None of them ever claimed to be Indian. They always claimed to be white. And you know, she was. We also spoke to people, a leader at Alcatraz in 1969. That would have been Lenita Warjack, and she told me that as far as she knew, Sasheen was never at Alcatraz, and you know, Lenita lived there full time for 18 months, and also was the leader of the Native Students of Berkeley. And so, yeah, I look through the sign and register, her name isn't there. And a lot of her story, when we tried to actually confirm the details of it, just did not add up. Even her name, Sasheen, you know, I'm Navajo. My mother, Navajo is her first language. And she claims that Navajos at Alcatraz had given her that name and that it meant little bear. In Navajo, little bear is Shushyaj. Doesn't sound much like Sasheen. And also, Navajo people don't name women after animals. That's just not our tradition. It would never happen unless the only way she would get a name like that was if someone was teasing her, and it wouldn't have been very nice teasing. And don't take a name that Navajo people are giving you in jest. And but later when I spoke to her sisters, they told me that, and they contacted me because they were quite outraged by how their father and their mother were being portrayed in international reporting after Sasheen's death. And they had thought that the lies she was telling would die down and that people would figure it out, but they could see that this was not happening 50 years after she had been at the Oscars. And so, so that was, her sisters had contacted me, and that's why I wrote the article in the Chronicle, and because they were quite upset.
So this is an incredibly fascinating story in and of itself. Mm-hmm. And I do link to a thoroughly documented article that you wrote on Substack, your Substack platform, in addition to which was published about the same time as that op-ed. I kind of want to get into the sort of what the fallout from that. I guess what I'm saying is I'm inviting people to read it because it would probably take up the whole show if we...
It's 44 pages long, the research. And that's only research that we, a small amount of the research we did on her
right.
family.
Which, yeah. So, and I want to get into this whole, the research that you and your people you're associated with are doing that's very thorough, very exhaustive. But I also neglected to tell people that if you hadn't looked at the website and seen that our phone system is down, which is another consequence of the what happened a week ago with the power outage or whatever the heck happened here, which caused some damage to our equipment, and so we are running on a limited capacity, and we don't have phone lines open. So I won't even give you the number. I apologize for that, but Jacqueline Keeler and I are here talking to you. And I guess if you have any, you can write to my Facebook, KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio Facebook page. Actually, I just thought of that. I'll have to bring that up. So that's one thing you can do if you have any questions or comments. So I also did want to once again remind you that we are in our membership drive. And we missed our regular fall drive. And now we do need $70,000 by December 31st to keep on the air, basically. I want to thank Molly just a minute ago. All right. And Tamar, sorry if I pronounced that wrong, 19 minutes ago. Boy, we've had a bunch of people call in. Molly, pardon me if I don't pronounce this right, Zhao Yan, Craig. These are all people in the past several hours. And you can join them. We've got, we're up over 6,000, so we're getting a good start. But yeah, 86 people have either texted KBOO to 44321 or gone to our website, which is not down, kboo.fm/give. You can also click donate in the mobile app, the KBOO mobile app, if you have such. Or you can do it the old-fashioned way by sending a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. You are listening to Wednesday Talk Radio. Again, we are not accepting call-ins because we can't. Our phone system's down. You know, Jackie, I was going through our old shows together. Uh-huh. You started out as a guest, I think, maybe it was around Standing Rock. I have this written down. Anyway, way back in 2016, Indigenous Resistance from Colonization. Actually, I think you were even earlier than that, early 2016. Anyway, I just want to read a few titles because sure. Indigenous Resistance from Colonization to the Termination Era to Trump. That was about almost exactly 6 years ago. Then, of course, with Standing Rock, we delved deeply into that. Report from Standing Rock with you and Louis Grassrope, the head man at the Osseti Sakoyan camp at Osseti Standing Rock.
Yeah.
Sorry, say that.
Osseti Sakoyan.
Thank you. And let's see. Beyond Columbus Day, changing the name is just the first step. One that I really remember, why reading Sherman Alexie was never enough. Tokenism in publishing meets the reality of epidemic violence against Native women. And I could go on and on. We had several dozen shows, I believe, all together. And I think we really brought us, you know, you brought. I thought we had some good chemistry, and we still do. And I thought you brought some really, really, really important stuff to KBOO's airwaves. And I hope people appreciate that. So this is your time now, listeners, to express your appreciation for KBOO in general, for Wednesday Talk Radio, for the work that Jacqueline Keeler does. Again, text KBOO to 44321, or you can go to kboo.fm/give, and we'll talk about that a little later. So getting back to the subject at hand, so you've been, I guess, you know, as a Native American, you're almost in some sense born an activist, or, you know, you're born forced to respond to the circumstances imposed upon your people or peoples. You, in particular, were born to activist parents, which is kind of a leg up in the activist world, as it were. You kind of were born into that. And it was a very activist-y time. There was a lot of the whole Red Power movement was going on. So you were kind of absorbed that. And, you know, as an adult, you got really involved in the mascots issue, which has really blown up, and there's been a lot of those tokens have been knocked down. So, would you see this the Pretendian issue as kind of an outgrowth of that? You already said how you were very attuned to it by seeing how the Pretendians were or a phenomenon. You know, from whenever you were conscious of these things. But talk a little bit about your development, your own consciousness about these things.
Yeah. So I think my parents met in Cleveland through the relocation program, which was a program two programs. One was a congressional act to terminate tribes politically, basically totally disappear us, our nations from the face of the earth. And then to facilitate this termination program, they created another program called the Relocation Program, which was to relocate young Native people to urban centers. And there were several cities chosen, and one was Cleveland, Ohio. And so that's how my parents met. And And they did become active. There was a lot of, you know, when you bring a bunch of young people together, I think overall they estimate like 20,000 young Native people went through Cleveland through that program, several thousand there any time. And you bring that many young Native people together and things happen. And one of the things they often go after are the mascot issues, including the Cleveland Indians. And I also went to Dartmouth College. And so when I got there as a freshman, I was introduced to the Indian issue there, which was, of course, they used to be called the Dartmouth Indians. And then,
oh, yes.
Yeah. And so we were warned about that as Native students by alumni, Native alumni that came to sort of counsel us our first freshman week. The first week, the freshmen are there alone on campus. And so we get all these little, panels and things. And one of them was a bunch of Native alumni explaining to us about the mascot issue. And that was the first time I'd really been aware of the mascot issue, was the Dartmouth Indian issue. And once they started bringing Native students on campus in the late 60s, early 70s to fulfill their original charter, which was to educate Indian youth and others, but they focused on the others.
They were like an early colonial institution, right?
Yeah. My husband's family went there before the Revolutionary War. It was actually placed there in Hanover, New Hampshire, to be closer to the Iroquois Confederacy so they could send their kids there. And so his ancestors are Mohawk and Seneca, and so a couple of his ancestors attended Dartmouth early on. Dartmouth, like, as I mentioned, has the Dartmouth Review, which is very closely tied to the National Review, and they were quite active, heavily funded by the alumni, like Dinesh D'Souza and what's that Laura lady? She has that show on Fox. What's her name? I've even written articles about her, and I can't remember. She's, you know, the awful right-wing lady. She used to be her. They both worked at the Dartmouth Review. They got their start there, and Laura Ingram. That's Laura Ingram.
Oh, yeah.
And Dinesh D'Souza both got their start at the Dartmouth Review. And so it was very. They were very aggressive, and they would hand out free Dartmouth T-shirts, Dartmouth Indian T-shirts, to all the freshmen. They'd just bring them, and they'd be wearing them on campus. And it was just, you know, I tried to tell my roommate to stop wearing it, and she wouldn't. To her, it was a non-issue, and it culminated with. This big standoff we had right before graduation. And yeah, it was, so that's what, that was the first time I'd really dealt with the issue. My parents, of course, were familiar with the Dartmouth, with the Cleveland Indian issue, but I wasn't really a big sports watcher, and I heard them talk about it. It was just something, you know, your parents talk about, and it's not really your issue, you know, at the time. And so I didn't really appreciate it till I was in college. And
how many Native students were there at Dartmouth when you were there?
Oh, gosh. You know, it's so hard because one of the things, the problems that come up in Pretendianism is that universities and colleges rely a lot on self-identification. And of course, the academy also doubled down on self-identification after my article about Sachin came out. So
the academy of, that's a follow-up question I wanted to ask you, which we can get into later. But so the Academy of Arts and Motion Pictures, they never really addressed.
No, they went ahead and doubled down on self-identification, which had served them so well, I guess. I don't know. Not very well. That's being me being ironic. So Dartmouth has a really great program, and a lot of real Native students attend there. But because they rely on self-identification, I later found out that some of the people around me were Pretendians and box checkers.
So there's so much, got a bunch of strands here. So not that you need to get into the psychology of it all, but one thing that you've talked a lot about is the benefits. So what sort of, what are, I guess, two questions. What are a lot of these people basing their claims on, and what are they getting out of it?
Yeah, so they're, you know, the whole issue of box checking came up recently in October in the Supreme Court case on affirmative action, where Justice Alito, Samuel Alito, was asking the university attorneys that were representing the universities and their program, their affirmative action programs, you know, about box checking, right? And the sad thing is, if affirmative action is overturned, it may be partly down to box checking, which is where people just check the box and claim to be something they're not. Last year, the Chronicle of Higher Education shared a survey that found that as many as 9 in 10 white men admitted to box checking, to be claiming to be Indian, right, being American Indian, and 3 in 10 white women admitted. So it's quite a cynical thing, and quite common, very common. You know, well, maybe I have an Indian ancestor somewhere in my tree. Let's just check the box, you know, and get a, you know, get into college or medical school or whatever. And but yeah, I think it's just that they're able to build their careers on it. And I think that the people we on the suspected pretendian, the alleged pretendians list, we had 200 people on there, and many of them had already been, you know, outed in newspaper articles and court cases, like the one the Cheyenne Nation brought, you know. But some of them had not been investigated thoroughly, and so we left it open to possibly that they are Native American, and maybe people just don't know. Most of the people on the list claim to be of descent, and so they claim to be of unverifiable descent from an unknown Native ancestor, and they don't know where that ancestor is in their tree. Right. So it's so people are pushing very, very vague claims and developing arguments to explain the lack of a Native ancestor in their tree.
Now, I apologize if I was not paying enough attention? Did you already explain the list that you're talking about?
Not in this show, but I have, I think, before. But I We took us a year and a half. I'm working with a sort of a volunteer group of Native researchers, tribal genealogists, professors, writers, you know, museum curators, all kinds of people, tribal leaders. And we went through the list, and we found that we were only able to verify the claims of 5 people. And so the list is pretty accurate, I would say, in identifying fraud. You know, that most of the people on the list, about 97%, we could not verify their claims. Some of them we could not verify them for, 2 of them because of adoption, which is not to say that they aren't Native, it's just that we were unable to verify the claim. But the vast majority was because that we were able to do their complete family trees. We built these trees out to, in some cases, 3,800 people, so like a big tree. And not only their direct line, but all of their relatives, you know, their distant cousins, and, you know, great aunts and uncles, and so just to see if anyone claimed, you know, you just keep building the tree out to see if you come across someone who is living in an Indian community, is identifying as Indian. Because even if their ancestors refuse to, they often make this claim that their ancestors appear to be white on paper, right? But actually were bigger, greater Indians than our ancestors. They call us paper Indians or treaty Indians because we collaborated with the colonial government by agreeing to be documented as Indians. But their ancestor who appears to be white, and their entire family tree that appears to be white, is actually an Indian tree because they were great Indians and they just refused to identify as Indians, right? And so the way we test this thing is, well, maybe their direct ancestor did not become documented, but, you know, his grandmother would be, you know, his niece would be, you know, and somebody would be, they'd be at some point, the family living in an Indian community, you know, with a whole bunch of Indian people around them. But when we build their trees out to their relatives, we find more white people. Those people are documented. Their lives are completely documented, you know, and we just end up with this massive white family tree, and we're trying to find the Indian. Sometimes it felt like literally like we were trying to turn a white family Indian, right? That was our goal here. But we were just trying to confirm their claims, right? And so we were unable to do that in most cases. And in fact, we just found giant trees of non-Indian people. So what we discovered, and what we did, when I started doing the research, I thought that the issue was that they would simply be a very distant descent. Like the more distant your ancestor was in your tree, 5, 6 generations back, the more likely you were to be hired, right? And but what we found instead, which we did not expect, was that this was a case of absolute fraud. These are people conducting fraud, and the unwillingness of institutions like academic institutions or the Academy of Motion Pictures and Sciences, you know, that their refusal to check or to confirm is facilitating this this con, right? This grift. And so that was very shocking, I have to say. I did not expect that to be the case. And in some cases, we're talking about like entire departments of Native Studies departments in universities, even one local to here. And so it's you know, and what is their psychology, right? What is the psychology of a pretendian, of someone who would live their life basically LARPing, right? Live action role playing a role, or in a form of constant red face, right? You know, I can't. We did notice that, for one, that they that even when they've been outed, they still persist, right? They will keep trying to assert the claim, even when they've been definitively outed. Two, that they are very aggressive against actual Native people in their employment. You know, I talked to a lot of Native American professors who have basically had their careers shut down because they asked a simple, innocent question, so who is your family, to a pretendian, right? And the pretendian, when asked who their family is, will rush off to the dean or the provost in the university and say, that Native American professor is racist against me because I look white, right? And so, you know, I actually had Native American professors tell me, I mean, these are Native people who are, you know, in their 50s and 60s, sometimes younger, and they're Native people who have PhDs, you know, some of the most highly educated Indian people in the country. And they are told by their deans that because they questioned a pretendian, that they are racist and they will never have a leadership role in Native studies in that university.
So we've got about 15 minutes left. This is, we've talked about this in the past. We've done several shows on this, which longtime listeners will remember. New listeners won't. So this some people are catching up. I'm Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on your community radio station. During our end of the year drive, just a quick reminder that we do depend on your support. We are a listener-sponsored station. That's a model that's worked for us for 54 years, for other stations for even longer. Pacifica in particular, it's a really beautiful model, and it works well, but it only works well if enough people participate. Less than 10% of our listeners are actually contributing members. We don't mind if you listen. We want people to listen. That's why we do radio. It's because we want people to hear what we have to say, because we think what we have to offer here at KBOO is important. I think that what Jacqueline Keeler has to offer is very important. But as I said, if we could up that percentage just a little bit, maybe get it, nudge it above 10%, it'd make our work a lot easier here. We'd have a more stable financial basis on which to operate. We had the kind of thing that can happen, like last week we had a power outage, some sort of a surge or something that shorted out some equipment. Our phones are down. A number of our systems are not in perfect working order. It's going to cost money to fix them. You know, it's just over and above the usual operating costs. So, you know, just to say that it's a real thing, that we do need your regular support. So if you could text KBOO to 44321, KBOO to 44321 on your mobile device, or if you could go to our website and just check out, you know, you could check out my program page, find out some of the links to what Jacqueline has written. From there, you can explore the issue even deeper if you would like. KBOO.fm/give, or just go to our homepage and click on the donate button. You can also mail your check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. You know, our programming speaks for itself. I could give you a lot more reasons, but I think what you're really here for is to listen to our programming. I'm so glad to have Jacqueline back after many months. I don't know how long it's been, over a year since we were co-hosting the show, and then you left to do your own show, and it ran its course. And you're still out there doing this research. I wanted to get into this the Sachin Littlefeather case. As I said, it became I don't know, possibly the biggest pretendian case nationally at this point, maybe. I don't know, that's not really important, but it's certainly given a lot more visibility to the issue. And what I kind of like to hear you talk about is the reactions to the piece on a lot of different fronts, you know, institutionally, but also in Indian country, among Native Americans yourselves. What has been some of the, you know, and I guess maybe just to ask another question, and you can run with this, is again, that the issue seems to have become a lot bigger. I notice that there's a Canadian documentary, The Pretendians. I notice there's a lot more nationally published. The New York Times had an article just last month, I believe, or in October. It's certainly yours and other people's work has certainly pushed this issue and made people take it a lot more seriously.
Yeah, I was really fortunate to have an editor at the paper support my work, and so with Satchin Little Feather, you know, she was on our list. We had confirmed that she was not from the tribes that she claimed, as an American Indian here in the United States with that political status and relationship to the U.S. government. She did not possess that, and certainly no experience with Indian foster care, any of these issues that she has spoken on in the paper and the things, and apparently was not significantly at Alcatraz. But when she was in August, the Academy announced that they were going to apologize to her for her treatment when she came, you know, in March 1973 to the 72 Oscars to refuse the Oscar for Marlon Brando for The Godfather. And that, you know, we knew that she wasn't Native, and so that kind of sat funny with us. I wasn't planning on doing an expose on her specifically. I was going to focus on someone else in Hollywood and sort of our modern Michelle Latimer, which is the Canadian pretendian who was outed by the Canadian Broadcasting Company maybe over a year ago. So I was forced to address this issue. And I was working on an article about that, and I submitted one in September after around the time of the event, right the week before, I think, the actual honoring. And if you go to the, I don't know if they still have those videos up, but they have like a 4-hour video up of an interview with Satchin Little Feather that the Academy did, and it was up on their YouTube channel last I checked. And she makes some pretty very strong claims to being American Indian, to, you know, being the first American Indian woman to stand on that stage, all these things. And I should also say some of her other claims, like about John Wayne trying to assault her, that's been, you know, critically sort of addressed by film historian writer Farhan Nemi, and definitely check out her blog, her Substack as well on that. But
so that may not have actually occurred.
Yeah, that probably didn't occur
because a lot was made of that.
Yeah. She and her claims about being, you know, blacklisted by Hoover. Hoover had already
That would be perfect, being assaulted, a Native American being assaulted by
John
Wayne.
Yeah, that was a story that was sort of started by one of the producers on the show, but it was just a tall tale, you know, type of thing. And then Satchin began quoting it a lot, and there's no evidence. He had lost half a lung, and he was not a well man at this point. He wasn't exactly able, and it was just not true. Never happened. And so, you know, these people who trade in tall tales, you know, they tend to tell a lot of them. You know, it's not just one thing just about being a fake Indian. It's all these other things that they lie about. And if you fact check them all, you can begin to see a pattern of being a fabulist, right? So I was working on the article, and then she passed away on October 2nd, and then he wanted me to change the article, but then I was contacted via Twitter by her sister Roz Cruz, and I was traveling at the time in Yellowstone, and so I didn't really see her attempts to contact me until another mutual friend or mutual contact let me know. So around, I think around, it was maybe, I don't know, I can't remember, it was after the funeral, after she died around October, it was probably the following week, October 8th or 9th that I finally, she got a hold of me. And I think I spoke to her, maybe it must have been October 10th, and then I spoke to her on October 11th. And then so we worked on the article, and she told me about the funeral that was coming up. And so, but both sisters came forward, and I did 6 hours of interviews with them. And they told me that they were not Native, that they were ashamed of what their sister had done, falsely claiming, you know, the trauma of another people. And they always thought it would blow over. They never thought it would persist, you know, and to see her sort of celebrated this way. They had other troubling tales, which I did not publish, about her mental illness and the violence that accompanied it. You know, they actually believe, and I don't have not seen a diagnosis to this effect. She was diagnosed as... We had put together a timeline of all her claims, because, you know, to keep track of them all, if you go on newspapers.com and you search her name, you'll find like 1,800 articles with interviews with her, right? She did a lot of interviews over 50 years, right? And so, so you know, kind of compiling all of her claims and comparing them. So we put together a pretty, it's on that research, the early part of the timeline is on the research on Substack. And, you know, trying to correlate and trying to fact check each claim. And one of the things I had not been able to fact check, and I immediately asked them, that was her time spent in a mental hospital when she was 20. She alluded to that a lot in her views. And of course, because of HIPAA laws and stuff, I could not independently confirm that it ever happened. And so HIPAA laws. And so I talked to the sisters, and they confirmed it, and they showed me the letters from the hospital that had been sent to their mother, and the diagnosis, which was schizophrenia with bipolar, right? And so she, I guess she tried to stab her roommate when she was in college at San Jose State. And the other girls in the dorm overwhelmed her and wrapped her in a bed comforter until the authorities came and they took her away in a straitjacket. And that's, so she spent a year in a mental hospital on Thorazine and stuff at Agnew State Hospital, just in the Bay Area. And they both sisters visited her at that time. And so I was able to confirm that. And really, it was after she got out of the mental health hospital that she began to sort of fashion this identity as Sachin Littlefeather, right? Hmm. And the sisters believe the name Sachin actually comes from, they were in 4-H as children, as young women, and they had made their own clothes. They said that was fairly common. They you can read the article, they contest that they were really that poor, you know. And they said it was really common back then in the 50s for people to make their own clothes and stuff like that. And it was just normal. And that they had a normal house. It wasn't this shack that she described and stuff. And they showed me pictures, so like we confirmed that. And But basically they use these ribbons called by the Sachin Ribbon Company. Oh. So they think her name came from that. And so it was interesting to get the family's perspective and you know, her depicting her father as a violent violent Indian man who wasn't fit to be in a white family is how she sort of depicted her dad, you know. But that turned out to be not true. I mean, he was very ill as well. He had cancer.
We're almost out of time.
Yeah.
I know that there's an article you wrote after that for the San Francisco Chronicle, talking about the implications of it. I'm trying to find it here. On Sachin Littlefeather Pretendians and What It Means to Be Native American, Why Sachin Littlefeather's Ethnic Fraud Matters More Now Than Ever Before. Maybe just in a real nutshell.
Yeah, that came out a couple weeks ago. I think that I really wanted to address a lot of the misinformation that was out there. I think some of the reporting that followed my article in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and also in a trade publication, Variety, really sort of misrepresented what was going on. For one, like I said, they don't define American Indian, you know, which a definition would be a tribal citizen of an extant Native nation that whose homelands are presently under occupation by the United States government and constitute the homeland of the United States, the lower 48 states, right? That's a very direct definition. And they also don't include a definition of pretendian, which is not a private person seeking to find their native ancestry in a private endeavor. The pretendians are people who have built their careers on being their on their claims to be American Indian, and sometimes for several decades. And so when you have someone who is a public person who has said things on the record, like, you know, in interviews in newspapers, in books that they publish, et cetera, or, you know, before Congress giving congressional testimony or speaking before the UN or at the Oscars, these are public statements that can be fact-checked, right? Like Herschel Walker claiming on his website, his campaign website, to have graduated from a university. You know, the news reporters don't have to call him up and say, repeat that claim to them. They can just fact check the published claim. And so that's what we did. We sought to fact check it. And so this idea that this is going to harm people who are trying to reconnect, right, is not an issue. And, you know, most Indian people don't monetize their identity. That's really unusual. I think I've mentioned quite frequently that I have 54 first cousins who are tribal citizens who are enrolled in federally recognized tribes, and almost none of them put it on their resume, right? So there's a standard of just fact-checking that is quite normal, particularly people who have built their careers on it.
And you can, again, go to kbo.fm Wednesday Talk Radio, or just go to Google Jacqueline Keeler, and you can get her articles and dive into this yourself. We are out of time. KBOO.FM/give or text KBOO to 44321. Please support this station and all that we do. Thanks, Jackie.
Thanks.
Bye, everybody.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
Volunteer-powered community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.